From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A huge comet is about to crash into Jupiter. David Levy says it will be the most cataclysmic event observed in our solar system since the dawn of civilization. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Levy about what we might learn from the crash, which will happen in mid-July. Levy is part of the team that discovered the comet. It's named after him and his partners. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of the Stravinsky dance, Les Noces. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Democrats in the House Ways and Means Committee have forced passage of a health care reform bill that meets President Clinton's demand of covering all Americans with health insurance. The bill requires businesses to pay for the bulk of insurance costs for their workers. Its passage came less than an hour after the Senate Finance Committee rejected compulsory health insurance for workers. That panel dumped Chairman Daniel Patrick Moynihan's requirement that employers help pay for insurance if other measures fail. A report released today by Whitewater Special Counsel Robert Fisk concludes that former White House counsel Vincent Foster committed suicide. NPR's Mara Liasson has more.
Fisk's 200-page report represents only a preliminary phase of what will be a much broader investigation into all the events surrounding Whitewater, but at the White House it was greeted with a sigh of relief because it closes the chapter on the most tragic aspect of the whole affair, the death of Vincent Foster. White House counsel Lloyd Cutler.
This should put to rest the irresponsible speculations, many of them politically motivated, that something more sinister had occurred. We hope these rumor mongers and those parts of the media that published their rumors will now leave the Foster family in peace.
Fisk also investigated a series of meetings between Treasury and White House officials and determined the meetings did not amount to an obstruction of justice. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Family Violence Prevention Fund is launching a series of public service announcements telling people that domestic violence is everyone's business. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
The ad campaign was in the works long before the O.J. Simpson case made the headlines, but sponsors are hoping to capitalize on the increased public attention to domestic violence. Radio and television ads will drum home the point that every 9 seconds a woman is beaten in this country.
Sometimes you only hear it. From a neighbor's apartment or out in the street. You want to stop it, but it's none of your business, right? But if someone were playing music too loud, you'd do something.
Reginald Brack, chairman of the Ad Council, says too often the word domestic seems to somehow lessen the seriousness of the crime.
Beating up a stranger gets you jailed. Beating up a wife land you in therapy.
The campaign will urge people to call the police, encourage the victim to report the problem, and in a calmer moment, confront the abuser and urge him to get professional help. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
A preliminary hearing into murder charges against O.J. Simpson have recessed briefly. Prosecutors have spent the day so far showing the court the evidence against Simpson, which will determine if murder charges are lodged against him. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen 38 points to 3,629. This is NPR. TV network CBS and home and shopping cable operator QVC say they're close to a merger agreement. Under the proposed plan, CBS Chairman Lawrence Tisch would stay chairman, and QVC Chairman Barry Diller would become chief executive officer of the new company, which would keep the CBS name. Diller once headed the Paramount Movie Studio. He also helped to build the Fox TV network, and he made an unsuccessful bid to acquire Paramount's company earlier this year. He's been looking ever since to gain a strong foothold in entertainment programming with QVC. Midwest farmers and ethanol producers are praising a ruling from the Environmental Protection Agency. It forces the smoggiest cities to use more ethanol-blended gasoline. But the oil industry says it will most likely challenge the ruling in court. From member station WCBU, Carl Volz reports.
The EPA ruling requires that 30% of the nation's reformulated gasoline contain ethanol or methanol. both of which have more oxygen. About 50% of corn-based ethanol is produced in Illinois. Howard Hinton is a vice president at Midwest Grain Products.
Farmers throughout the agricultural America and grain processing companies like ourselves a chance to grow and expand in this important piece of business.
Farm groups say the ruling will boost the price of corn by 15 cents a bushel. Meanwhile, the Illinois Petroleum Council says the EPA ruling will take away jobs from the oil industry. For National Public Radio, this is Carl Volz in Peoria, Illinois.
The governing body of World Cup Soccer has suspended star Argentine soccer player Diego Maradona from all play. It says he's tested positive for banned drug substances. The body says it will make a final decision on his future in world soccer only after the World Cup tournament is over on July 17th. Maradona tested positive for 5 banned substances. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A cataclysmic event is about to happen in our solar system. A huge comet is going to crash into the largest planet, Jupiter. The comet has broken up into pieces that will hit Jupiter over a period of 6 days, beginning July 16th. My guest, David Levy, is part of the team that discovered this comet last year. The comet is named after him and his partners, Carolyn and Eugene Shoemaker. Levy is an amateur astronomer who has discovered 21 comets. His latest books are A Quest for Comets and Sky Watching. All the major telescopes on Earth and in space will be watching Jupiter in mid-July. You can see some of the images transmitted from NASA on public TV July 20th on a program called The Great Comet Crash. Levy will be one of the guests. This is the first time in history we'll be able to watch what happens when a comet strikes a planet. I asked Levy why that's such a big deal.
It's a major deal because comets have had an enormous influence in the history of the Earth and in the development of life on Earth. Comets, we think, brought the Earth's water supply here. If it weren't for a long series of comet impacts over the years, especially the early years, we probably wouldn't have any water here. Also, we think that comets brought the seeds of life to Earth, the carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen. That are the seeds of life, the simple alphabet of life, as one scientist has said. But probably most important, a comet impact that's probably about the size of the one that's about to hit Jupiter resulted in the end of the dinosaur era on the Earth 65 million years ago. So with all of this importance that comets have had, it's fabulous that we finally have the chance to see an impact in action, to see something like this actually hit a planet. And fortunately, the planet isn't Earth, it's Jupiter this time.
Yeah, really, I'm glad it's very far away.
Yeah.
Well, this is going to be some crash. Give us a sense of the magnitude of the crash of this comet when it hits Jupiter.
Well, if you were to take all of Earth's nuclear weapons, everything that was owned by the former Soviet Union and the United States at the height of the Cold War, put them all in a box and light a match to it, and multiply the result by about 10,000 times, this is about what the energy we're talking about that will be released in the explosions this summer on Jupiter. So it's a major explosion. The bomb physicists are really excited about it. The comet scientists.
The nuclear bomb physicists expect to learn something from this crash?
Oh, yes. In fact, I guess the most famous one of all, Edward Teller, the inventor of the hydrogen bomb, immediately got really excited when he heard that this comet was hitting Jupiter. He's aware of how much energy is involved in the explosion of a comet. The reason that it's going to be so much is partly the size of the comet, but mostly the speed. It's coming down at about 60 kilometers per second, which means about 140,000 miles an hour. These comets are going to be hitting Jupiter at an enormous speed. And all that energy gets released all of a sudden, which means we're going to have a very large explosion. Unfortunately, we don't know how much of it we'll actually see, but there is a lot of energy that'll be released.
How big are these pieces of comet that will strike Jupiter?
That's the big mystery right now. Even though we've observed this comet so carefully with the Hubble Space Telescope, we have not been able to penetrate a thick cloud of dust that surrounds each of the comets. And so all we can do now is give an estimate. They're probably no smaller than about a half a mile across and probably no larger than about 2.5 miles across.
We should explain this. This comet has basically broken up, so it's going to crash into Jupiter like it were a string of pearls. It's not going to be one crash. It's going to be a series of crashes.
Yeah, when we found the comet last March, it looked as if someone had stepped on it. In fact, Carolyn Shoemaker, in first seeing the image, said, "I don't know what this is, but it looks like a squashed comet, and it looks as if someone had stepped on it." And what had happened was that on July the 7th, 1992, this comet passed by Jupiter, so close to Jupiter, about 21,000, less than that, about 15,000 miles from the planet's cloud tops. The planet's gravity just reached up almost like a fist and yanked the comet into pieces, and it split it up into more than 20 pieces on that day.
Now Jupiter is a gaseous planet like the Sun, but it's much cooler than the Sun. So what happens when a comet crashes into a gaseous planet? It's got to be different than, say, if it hit Earth, a solid mass.
Oh, yes. A comet like this hitting the Earth would make a very large crater in the ground. It would gouge out an enormous area of land. The dinosaur comet 65 million years ago created a hole in the ground that was about 150 miles wide, and it did all that in just a few seconds. This one, though, is hitting Jupiter, which, as you say, is a gas planet, but it's very cold gas. The comets are going to come into this cold gas that has about the consistency of frozen jello. So it's not going to be able to go right through it. It's going to reach a very heavy area of gas and then simply explode in that. The gas is really very cold. It's not in any danger of igniting because hydrogen, even though there's a lot of hydrogen gas, hydrogen needs oxygen in which to ignite, and there isn't any oxygen on Jupiter. So we know that it's different from landing on the Earth. But we really don't know how it's different, and we don't know how long the effects, like any storms that might form in Jupiter's atmosphere, might last. All we know is that there's an awful lot of energy that will be released in a very short time, more than we've ever seen before in our solar system.
Jupiter is the largest planet in the solar system. What else should we know about Jupiter to really appreciate this event that's about to happen?
Well, Jupiter is the by far the largest planet in the solar system. In fact, it has 99% of the mass of the solar system, except for the Sun, is out there in Jupiter. Jupiter is kind of like the solar system's vacuum cleaner. If it weren't for Jupiter, we probably wouldn't be here on Earth today because the Earth would be getting hit by major dinosaur-killing comets every million years or so. It would happen so often that life would probably not have ever had a chance to evolve on Earth. But because there's Jupiter out there with its enormous gravity well, it just kind of cleans up the comets. Most of the comets that approach Jupiter go nearby, past Jupiter very quickly, and then escape from the solar system. So we have, it's kind of like how Voyager 2 and Voyager 1 passed Jupiter and picked up speed an awful lot and eventually escaped from the solar system. With a few of those comets, however, they do not escape from the solar system. They continue to go around Jupiter for a while, and as this one is showing us, they actually leave the solar system by hitting Jupiter. We think that the event that we're seeing next month is something that takes place perhaps once every 1,000 years. Maybe a little more often than that, maybe not quite as often as that, but it's a very rare event and something that we're really lucky that we're able to watch right now.
This is the first time we have equipment that can allow us to monitor to some extent what's happening in a crash of this magnitude. So what exactly will astronomers be able to see on Earth?
Well, that's...
That's a good question, right? Nobody
knows
for sure.
That's a real complicated question. Technically nothing, because our seat on Earth is behind a post.
Mm-hmm.
The comets are going to come up from the south, zip around the back end of the planet, disappear, and crash a few seconds later. However, there are a couple of really lucky things that we have in place. There's a large spacecraft called Galileo on its way to Jupiter, just happens to be in a position where it will be able to see all of the impacts directly. And we should be able to get beautiful pictures from Galileo that show the comets breaking up and smashing into the planet. It could be very spectacular. But the other good news is that less than a half hour after every impact, Jupiter's rapid rotation period will pull the planet around, pull the impact sites around, so that we will then will be able to see everything. We'll be able to see whatever is left after about half an hour, if any little storms have formed, any other effects on Jupiter. The moment of truth is July the 16th at night, when the first of the 21 fragments hits Jupiter. 20 minutes later, Jupiter's rotation moves the impact site so that we can see it, and every major telescope on Earth or in space that can look at Jupiter is going to be watching to see what happens. This is the largest campaign for a single astronomical event in the history of astronomy. It's a very exciting event to watch.
If it's a clear night in our listeners' neighborhoods, will we be able to see anything with our naked eyes?
No, Jupiter is not going to show any changes that dramatic. However, I recommend that people go out to look at Jupiter, because Jupiter is always fabulous to look at. With the naked eye, all you have to do is look in the southwest. Starting now, actually you look in the south right now, by impact day, which will be on the 16th of July, you'll be looking in the southwest, high in the southwest in the early evening. You'll be able to see Jupiter there. With a pair of binoculars, especially if you lean against the wall of a house and point the binoculars up towards Jupiter to give them a little stability, then you might be able to see Jupiter's moons. These are the same moons that Galileo discovered in 1610 and for which he was almost tortured by the Inquisition. You can see those with binoculars. With the smallest of telescopes, you can see bands of lines of clouds around the equator of Jupiter. These are things that are always glorious to look at, and almost everyone does not have that experience of seeing how beautiful Jupiter is. So what I recommend is that you go out there with a telescope or with binoculars and look at Jupiter, just so that you'll be a part of what's happening out there in this important event in Jupiter's life. But then to come inside and watch the pictures from Hubble Space Telescope coming in on the television is the other way that you'll be able to see what's happening.
This is going to be really loud, isn't it, when the comet crash happens? Is there a way of registering the sound?
Well, there actually is, not so that you actually hear it, but through a type of telescope called a radio telescope, which gathers energy from what's happening in Jupiter. And we should be able to, in a way, hear, but I put the word hear in quotation marks because it's not something we can actually hear over the long distance of space through which the sound would travel. Sound cannot travel in a vacuum, so it's not something we can hear directly. But maybe with a radio telescope we'll be able to get something like that.
What are you hoping to learn from this crash?
Well, I think the first thing is that we want to learn about Jupiter. We have never been able to penetrate very far below the cloud deck on Jupiter. We know this is the biggest planet in the solar system. We don't know what lies underneath it. We expect that these impacts will create a seismic wave that'll travel through Jupiter, possibly bouncing right off the core. We've never detected the core, and it'll be really neat if we could detect that Jupiter has a core that's about the size of the Earth. The other thing is, we'd like to learn a little bit about what Jupiter's atmosphere is made of. We would like to learn, we've already learned an awful lot about how fragile comets are. You know, it's amazing how there could be objects in space that are as fragile as comets are. You can virtually, if you were to be walking on a comet, you could break a comet apart with your hands. They are hardly put together with anything at all. Probably they are not much more, they're not much stronger than than if you had a sphere of water out in space and just sort of sitting there and not moving any place. The interesting thing, though, that it is amazing that something that fragile could last as long as it has. Comets have lasted since almost the very beginning of the solar system. So it'll be fabulous to learn about what keeps comets together and also what tears them apart.
David Levy is my guest. He's an astronomer who has discovered about 21 comets, including co-discovering the comet that we're talking about, the Red Comet that's about to crash into Jupiter in mid-July. He's also the author of several books. His two new ones are called The Quest for Comets and Sky Watching. David, let's take a break and then we'll talk some more.
Sure.
This is Fresh Air. My guest is astronomer David Levy. Will the Hubble Space Telescope play a role in this? There was such a long period when it was not functioning the way astronomers hoped. Is it back in shape, and will it help us?
Yes, Hubble Space Telescope is definitely back in shape. The astronauts' attempt to repair it last December was extremely successful. The telescope is doing everything we had ever hoped for it to do. It is a wonderful telescope. It is also capable of showing Jupiter almost as clearly as the Voyager spacecraft showed it. And we have this fabulous telescope that's only really been operating for a year, poised to show us an event on Jupiter that might take place once in 1,000 years. You can't believe what luck we're having. And the telescope is going to be spending a good deal of that week looking at Jupiter, just to see what kind of changes there have been in the planet since then.
What detail do you see exactly in a gaseous planet? It's not like you can see trees and lakes and houses and people.
No. Jupiter, you know, for those of us who saw the Voyager 2 pictures of Jupiter, Jupiter is like a Rembrandt painting. It's absolutely gorgeous, very rich colors, because the different parts of the atmosphere, depending on how high they are, display different colors. The blues are a little lower down in the atmosphere, and the whites are sort of in the intermediate layer in the atmosphere, and the reds, like the Great Red Spot, are kind of very high up in the atmosphere where things are really cold. And you can see these things from any telescope on Earth, really, even a small telescope. Jupiter is a very colorful planet.
Will there be any effects on Earth? Will our weather be changed? Will anything else happen?
No, not this time. We're lucky. We have a 500 million mile distance between Jupiter and the Earth right now, and all the effects are going to be confined to Jupiter. We're not going to have the only effect that it'll have on the Earth is just going to get everybody very excited about seeing something like this. It's really nice to know. You know, when we were in fourth grade and we took our geography class, and in the fourth grade they told us that the solar system was made 4.5 billion years ago. Well, now we know that it's not really true, that the solar system has never been finished. And this summer we're going to see, you and I are going to be able to see, a little bit of the solar system change. There'll be a comet that is not going to exist anymore, and Jupiter is going to have it's going to be just a little bit different for a while. And so the solar system is really a work in progress. It's moving along very nicely, thank you, but it's not finished. And observing Jupiter at this time, when it's undergoing such interesting changes, should really be fascinating.
Where are you going to observe from?
I'm going to be in Washington, D.C. I get to use a large refractor telescope with a lens at the United States Naval Observatory. The Planetary Society is sponsoring a public observing night down there, and I'm going to get to be a part of that. There are public observing nights, by the way, in almost every city in the country. I think if you call your planetarium or museum, I know that nature company stores are having an awful lot of public observing sessions in conjunction with the impact. Local astronomy clubs will be having special star parties that we'll be able to go and take a look at Jupiter during that week. There should be a lot of opportunity to go out and enjoy the sight of Jupiter during this important week.
When you look ahead, what are your wildest hopes and your worst fears for disappointment?
It's not really... I can give you my wildest hopes. And that is, of course, that the comets are a lot larger than we suspected, and that they're going to come into Jupiter and cause a lot of interesting special effects. And of course, I could say that my fears are that Jupiter will take a look at these comets, will swallow them, will go gloop, and there won't be anything at all for us to see. But I think that's not the right way of looking at this event. The success of this event is not measured by the size of the special effects that we get. This is a fundamental event in the solar system, and anything that happens is going to be great. This is too important an event just to say, well, are the effects as good as they are in a movie theater? It's really an awe-inspiring thing we're seeing, and anything we see is going to be fabulous.
There's no chance this is going to have the Comet Kohoutek syndrome where everything fizzles at the last minute?
Comet Kohoutek, 1973. You know, that was predicted. They said it would be the comet of the century. And sure enough, comets have minds of their own, and the comet of the century got shy at the last minute, and very few people saw it. This is a very different kind of event from Comet Kohoutek. That was a comet. The only thing it needed to do was to get bright, and it didn't do that. This is a very different kind of event. This is an event in which a series of comets that has already been very exciting by splitting apart into 21 pieces are going to crash into Jupiter at 140,000 miles an hour. We have no idea what that's going to produce. It may show absolutely nothing. It may be quite exciting and showing new clouds and storms on Jupiter that last for a few weeks. We don't know what that'll do. But we do know that impacts are a major event in the solar system. They've shaped the course of life on Earth here, and they have shaped the building of the planets over the last 4.5 billion years. And the fact that we get to see one is really great. You know, it's almost as if the telephone rings and you pick it up and nature is at the other end of the line and nature says, listen, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to drop 21 comets into Jupiter at 140,000 miles an hour each. All I want you to do is watch. And we're being given this gift from nature, and all we have to do is watch it, and that we're going to do. Anything that happens is going to be exciting. This is definitely not a comet that could become bright or might not become bright. It is not Comet Kohoutek. This is a major fundamental event that we are watching, and it's going to be exciting no matter what happens.
David Levy is part of the team that discovered the comet, which will smash into Jupiter in mid-July. His latest books are The Quest for Comets and Sky Watching. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Levy will be back in the second part of our show. In the meantime, here's, you guessed it, Bill Haley and the Comets.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock. 5, 6, 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, rock. 9, 10, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, rock. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your flat rags on. Join me, hon. We'll have some fun when the clock strikes one. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. When the clock strikes 2, 3, and 4, if the band slows down, we'll yell for more. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight. We're gonna rock, rock, rock till broad daylight. We're gonna rock around the clock tonight.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, Hunting Comets, part two of our discussion with amateur astronomer David Levy. He'll tell us about the night in 1993 when he and his partners discover the comet that will crash into Jupiter in July. The comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 is named after him and his partners. Levy has discovered 20 other comets. Some of those discoveries were made observing the sky from his own backyard. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Stravinsky's Les Noces and Village Wedding Songs by the Pokrovsky Ensemble. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The Clinton administration has targeted China for possible trade sanctions. This is part of a dispute over charges that China hasn't properly protected American patents and copyrights. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor says the administration will launch an investigation immediately. American businesses say they lose $800 million every year in China because of copyright piracy. An official report has suggested that the Hutu government in Rwanda systematically planned the killings that have swept the country. An investigator for the United Nations says the massacres of the minority Tutsis appear to have been planned before the death of the Rwandan president in an April plane crash. The BBC's Mark Fisher reports.
The report by René Denis Segui of the Ivory Coast does not mince words. In a stream of accusations against the Hutu leaders of Rwanda, it says that the term genocide is appropriate to describe what has been done to the country's Tutsis. The report says the massacres seem to have been prepared by a campaign of exhortation to ethnic hate and violence. From the end of last year, the report says, arms were distributed to pro-government militias and they were given lists of opposition leaders to execute. In a report compiled after he led a United Nations team on a visit to Rwanda earlier this month, he says that the massacres are without precedent in Africa. The report also suggests that widespread estimates of a death toll of 500,000 people in the past 3 months, which includes Hutu opponents of the government, could prove conservative.
Mark Fisher reporting. An official report finds that error by a control tower led to the March plane crashes at Pope Air Force Base in North Carolina. 23 Fort Bragg paratroopers were killed when an F-16 jet collided with another plane and then crashed into a third on the ground. The report says the jet was practicing how to land in accident conditions, and it says four of the five air traffic controllers in the tower did not have any training in how to deal with the situation. Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala is demanding more action against domestic violence. Shalala alluded to the Simpson case today as she unveiled a new campaign against domestic violence. She called on people aware of such situations to help people who are victims of it.
We can support the victims, the women and the children, by listening to their concerns, by encouraging them to call their local domestic violence hotline, by going with them to report the problem to a counselor, to a minister, or to the police. And don't let batterers get away with the violence either.
Shalala has unveiled the new Family Violence Prevention Fund campaign to promote the ending of domestic violence. A surge in long-term interest rates sent stock prices falling today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled 42 points to close at 3,624. Declines topped advances in heavy trading. This is NPR. PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat is changing his travel plans to Gaza to accommodate the religious observances of Israeli soldiers. Israel's foreign minister says Arafat will arrive tomorrow afternoon. That is so the Israeli soldiers who will be providing security for his arrival will be able to observe the Jewish Sabbath. Arafat was initially supposed to arrive in Gaza on Saturday. Two tense women's semifinal tennis matches were the highlight of Day 10 at Wimbledon today. Frank Vardeniga has details from Wimbledon.
Martina Navratilova has kept her dream alive of winning 10 Wimbledon crowns by advancing to the women's final with a hard-fought 6-3, 7-6 victory over the Puerto Rican-born Gigi Fernandez. Navratilova clinched victory in the tough semi-final hit-out, taking the second set tiebreak 8-6. The high-standard match saw Fernandez sizzle many impressive backhands past her opponent, while Navratilova stayed cool under pressure despite being 1 point away from splitting sets. Navratilova will now meet Spain's Conchita Martinez, the third seed, who survived a lengthy three-set struggle to move into her first Grand Slam final, ousting Texan Laurie McNeil 3-6, 6-2, 10-8. For National Public Radio, this is Frank Vardeniger at Wimbledon.
Whitewater Special Counsel Robert Fisk has released his first report on the Whitewater investigation. He says White House officials did not commit any crimes when they talked about the matter with regulators from the Treasury Department. Fisk says there isn't enough evidence to show that anyone in the White House tried to wrongly interfere with the investigation into President Clinton's Arkansas finances. The government says Americans' personal income rose 0.6% in May. That is the fourth straight monthly gain. Consumer spending was also up. The Commerce Department says this rose 0.4% in the same month. Spending makes up 2/3 of the nation's economic activity, and it's gone up in 12 of the last 14 months. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Comets are beautiful to watch. Their force has the power to alter the solar system. David Levy is a comet hunter who has discovered 21 of them. He co-discovered the comet that will crash into the largest planet, Jupiter, in mid-July. As he told us in the first part of our show, this is a major event in the solar system, and it's the first time humans will be able to observe a comet crashing into a planet. Let's talk about the night that you co-discovered the comet named after you, Shoemaker-Levy 9, named after you and Carolyn and Jean Shoemaker. Was it a good night for observing?
Not at all, Terry. This was a very strange night. It was mostly cloudy. I just felt that we wanted to continue observing. We've had so many bad nights because of weather. We've been weathered out so often that I just wanted to keep on observing. And after some debate, we decided to use some substandard film that we just had lying around, really. We put that film into the telescope because the night was so poor that we felt that it wasn't worth using our regular supply of film for. So we put this poor quality film into the telescope, and the very first film we took on that film was the one that on the following afternoon Carolyn discovered Shoemaker-Levy 9.
Since it was substandard film, when Carolyn discovered the comet, did you think it was just a flaw in the film?
We definitely thought it could be a flaw in the film. As a matter of fact, the first thing you need to do when you discover a comet, of course, is to report it. The person who's in charge of understanding everything that's in the sky that moves like a comet or an asteroid or explodes like a supernova, that person is Brian Marsden of the Central Bureau for Astronomical Telegrams in Massachusetts. And Brian is responsible for knowing where all the comets are in the sky. So the first thing we did after the discovery is to let him know about it. But then we had to get it confirmed, and by now it was snowing at Palomar. So I called a friend of mine who was observing at Kitt Peak in Arizona. His name is Jim Scotty. And Jim immediately, when I gave him the positions of the comet, he said, "David, you don't have a comet. You have a reflection of Jupiter on your films. I mean, you're talking about taking the picture on a partly cloudy night. You're talking about this strange squashed comet appearance." And I noticed that the positions indicate that the comet is moving exactly the same direction and exactly the same speed that Jupiter is moving, and Jupiter is very nearby. I think you have a reflection in your telescope. And my only answer to him could be, "Well, Jim, it might be, but could you take a look at it anyway?" And he said, "Sure, I'll take a look." And a couple of hours later, when I called him back, I asked him if he still thought it was a reflection, and he said, "No, it's not a reflection. You have a real comet. It's the most exciting comet I've ever looked at." He described it as being several condensations with dust joining them, with dust tails going off in one direction, and with wings going off in two other directions, making the whole thing look like a B-2 bomber. And it was... I told Jim that, you know, it's really exciting that you did this for us, and thank you for taking the time. And he said, "David, don't thank me. I'm probably going to spend the rest of my night on this comet. I may spend the rest of the observing period on this comet." As it turned out, Jim has done almost nothing else since the discovery of the comet. He is going to be one of those rare lucky few to be at a big telescope during the night of the impacts to be able to see if there's anything to see.
I guess it was pretty exciting for you to find out that
your discovery was a discovery of major magnitude.
Well, usually when I find a comet, I get excited for a while, and then after a few days, the excitement dies down. With SL9, the excitement has just kept on building. It's been one surprise after another. First, that the comet existed at all. Second, we find out that it looks as though it passed Jupiter in 1992 and broke apart. Third surprise, this comet doesn't even know how to orbit the Sun. It appears that it is in orbit about Jupiter. And the fourth surprise is that next July, or this July now, the comet is going to hit Jupiter. So it's just one exciting thing after another.
Why are comets formed? Do they have any kind of cosmic function?
Hmm. Well, comets were formed at the beginning of the solar system. There was a big continuum range of objects. The larger ones formed the planets. The smaller ones were these icy bodies that became the comets. Most of them, in the early years of the solar system, were swung away from this part of the solar system and moved into a new orbit way, way, way far from Earth. We call this the Oort cloud, O-O-R-T, after Jan Oort, the Dutch astronomer who postulated it. And it consists of many millions of comets very far from the Earth. And every now and then, a passing star will knock a few of them in orbits that take them back closer to the Earth again. And this is what we think might have happened with Shoemaker-Levy 9.
You've said that when you teamed up with the Shoemakers, that you learned a new way of looking for comets. Could you tell us briefly what that way is?
Yeah, instead of looking through a telescope at the sky, we're taking photographs of the sky. We take two photos of each area of the sky, and then they're examined using a stereo microscope, just like those funny glasses we used in the 50s to watch movies. So if a comet appears to move from one film to the other, we see it appear to float on top of the background stars. It's a very elegant way of hunting for comets.
My guest is astronomer David Levy. He co-discovered the comet that will crash into Jupiter in July. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. Back with astronomer David Levy. This comet bears your name. It's the Shoemaker-Levy 9, meaning it's the ninth comet that you co-discovered with the Shoemakers. Is it always the case that comets are named after the person or people who discover it?
It has been the case since Charles Messier's time in 1759. He discovered his first comet back then and his last comet around 1801. He was the first person to discover comets as part of an organized program. And at the time, they had the King of Denmark gave an award for everyone who had discovered a new comet. And that started the tradition of the discoverer's name being attached to the comet. It is a tradition that has lasted over 200 years. And we have either individual discoverers, like from my backyard, I found Comet Levy in 1990, and they're team discoverers as well, so that you have Shoemaker-Levy 9, which is the ninth short-period comet that we found from Palomar. It's a long tradition, a very nice one. It kind of personalizes the comets, which is a nice thing to do, because comets, more than almost any other object you can imagine, are very personal. Every comet looks different from every other comet, and a single comet can change its appearance from night to night as its tail grows and shrinks. So comets are very personal things.
Well, what exactly is a comet made of, and how is it formed?
Well, in the 1950s, Harvard's Fred Whipple suggested that comets are like dirty snowballs, that they consist of ices, water ice, carbon monoxide ice, carbon dioxide, cyanogens, all kinds of different ices that sort of act as the glue to hold rocks together, loose stones. So we called it a dirty snowball. More recently, there's more dirt than snow, so maybe it's an icy mud ball. And comets seem to be consisting like that. When they get close to the sun, however, the pressure of the energy from the sun, the solar wind, causes them to react, and very quickly the ices evaporate. They go directly to from a solid to a gas. The real word is called sublimation. And very quickly a coma will form around the comet. The coma could be for a 5-mile wide comet. The coma can be larger than the Earth. And then more of that material gets sent off into the tail of the comet.
Why do you look for comets?
I look for comets because it's a lot of fun. I've always been interested in comets, both in history, comets in literature, and the science of comets. But comet hunting is a very, very peaceful thing to do. I'm sitting outside in my yard in Tucson with a fairly large telescope, 16-inch diameter telescope, and it's very, very quiet. The hour before dawn is very nice and beautiful and pleasant. And I'm watching the sky, moving the telescope about one or two diameters of the moon every second, and just peacefully watching what the sky has to offer me. It might be an interesting red star, it might be a strange galaxy, or it might be a new comet. But it's the sky's show, and it's a very peaceful time for me to be searching for comets.
What does it take to be good at discovering comets, besides the equipment and the patience and time?
Well, that's a good question. Most people think you have to know the sky really well. I don't think so. I think it helps if you know the sky a little bit. What really is important is that you know what a comet looks like. It's so similar to bird watching. It's amazing how close the two fields are to each other. One on the Earth, tiny animals, the other enormous bodies in space. But really, the key to identifying a bird is you just know what the bird's distinctive marks are. You just know that a robin is different from a penguin. In the same way, you need to know what a comet looks like in the sky. A comet is not a galaxy, and it has a slightly different appearance from a galaxy. And with a lot of experience, you just get to know what a comet looks like. And when you see one in your telescope, right away you stop moving the telescope and you think, this has got to be a comet. I've got to see if it's going to move like a comet moves and then report it.
So what does it look like to you in your telescope?
A new comet might look like if you're looking at a blackboard and you see an eraser mark on the blackboard. Compared to the background of stars, a comet looks like a faint fuzzy spot of light.
So it's hard to see.
Very hard to see. Most of the comets that I've found, I think if I had been doing this 20 years ago, I would have just missed them. I just would have passed right over them without looking for them. Comets are usually, when they're discovered, they're right at the edge of your limit of vision, and you really need to know what that tiny brightening in the sky is, because sometimes a faint comet is just that.
Do you ever worry about a comet hitting Earth one day?
Well, I don't worry about it, but it is going to happen. A typical comet like the size of Shoemaker-Levy 9 might hit the Earth every 100 million years, doing a lot of damage. A smaller comet might hit maybe every 100,000 years, and an asteroid might hit that often, doing a lot less damage than the comet would. So it's something that we have to be concerned about. I think it would help if we were to find all of the asteroids, at least, that were in orbits capable of causing these objects to hit the Earth someday. I think that's a really important thing to do, just for insurance purposes, so that we know where these asteroids are and that we know that none of them are going to hit us in the next 1,000 years or so.
Will all the astronomers around the world be communicating to each other via the Internet on the days that the comet's crashing into Jupiter?
Yes, that's what most of us will be using is the Internet. The activity on the Internet is pretty strong right now. People are submitting their observations. There are things we call exploders, which when you send your observation to one person, it suddenly goes out to many people. And this is the one important way that I will be keeping up to date with what's happening, as these things are going to happen very fast, I think, between July 16th and July 22nd. And I want to keep up to date with what's going on, partly because of my own interest in it, but also that I will probably be called upon to try to explain what's happening, and I want to understand myself what's going on in this very complicated week.
Well, I want to say congratulations for co-discovering the comet.
Well, thank you very much, Terry.
And I hope you find thrilling things to discover on the nights that it crashes. And I thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. Thanks for inviting me. This was a lot of fun.
David Levy co-discovered the comet that will crash into Jupiter in mid-July. You can see images of the crash transmitted from NASA on a program called The Great Comet Crash, which will be broadcast on many PBS stations July 20th. Levy will be one of the guests. His latest books are The Quest for Comets and Skywatching. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. Renee Montaigne reports from Los Angeles on the preliminary hearings in the murder charges against O.J. Simpson. Joe Palka explains the DNA testing of blood samples in a case like this, why it takes so long to complete those tests. Michael Scholar reports on his travels into Rwanda, where Tutsi refugees feel threatened despite the presence of French military. Chitra Raghavan takes us inside the lawmaking machinery on Capitol Hill, seeing how a health care bill is put together. Nina Totenberg on today's decisions at the Supreme Court. Also, letters from listeners once again about satire from Harry Shearer on the O.J. Simpson affair.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. There's a new Stravinsky recording that classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz is excited about because it places a major Stravinsky score in a radically new context, Russian folk music.
In 1914, right after the phenomenal success of his three landmark ballets, The Firebird, Petrushka, and The Rite of Spring, Stravinsky started on a new dance work based on Russian folk poems. It's now known by its French title, Les Noces, The Wedding. It took Stravinsky 9 years to compose, 6 of those years just to find the right instrumentation. At the time, he insisted that only one passage, based on a factory song, was not his own original music. But this new album by the wonderful Russian folk group, the Pokrovsky Ensemble, proves that Stravinsky used more folk music than he originally admitted. In this passage from the beginning of Les Noces, the bride laments because her single braid, the symbol of her virginity, is going to be divided into two halves. Now here's a haunting Russian folk song with some identical words and a very similar melodic contour. In much of his best work, Stravinsky borrowed tunes the way Shakespeare borrowed plots and made them completely his own. What's even more exciting about this album is that the performance is not in the concert style we're used to, but in the style of real folk singing. The powerful, earthy sound is pushed out from the chest and through the nose, with no vibrato.
A few years ago, the Bulgarian State Radio and Television Female Vocal Choir made a tremendous splash with similar vocal qualities. This doesn't necessarily mean it's the only way or even the best way to perform Les Noces. After 1917, Stravinsky was trying to distance himself from Russia and the Bolshevik Revolution. In both his own recordings of Les Noces, made 25 years apart, he uses classically trained singers and the same stilted English translation. He said he didn't want to reproduce an actual folk wedding, but to suggest formal wedding rituals in an abstract, almost disembodied way. Here's what The Bride's Lament sounds like on Stravinsky's own 1959 recording. The soprano is Mildred Allen. The four percussive pianists are composers Samuel Barber, Aaron Copland, Lucas Foss, and Roger Sessions. Stravinsky evidently began with a more mechanical sound than pianos in mind. He even experimented with a player piano. Dmitri Pokrovsky uses computer-generated piano sounds, but it seems the wrong kind of artifice. The only wrong note on a disc which, it can be truly said, is as wildly exhilarating as it is educational.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Les Noces and Village Wedding Songs, performed by the Pokrovsky Ensemble in the Electra Nonsuch Explorer series. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Joan Tuohy, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers, with Nancy Greenlees and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Louisa Shafia. Our interns are Abby Beshkin, Philo Holland, and Marcus Tossig. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, an interview with British actress Joan Plowright. She's starring in the film Widow's Peak. And we hear from singer Leslie Gore, who made the hits It's My Party, Judy's Turn to Cry, and You Don't Own Me. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.